Welcome to the Green Lectionary Podcast, a production of Creation Justice Ministries. The Green Lectionary is a conversation on Scripture through the lens of creation justice. My name is Derek Weston, and today we will be looking at a text for Earth Day. For this episode, I am joined by co-executive directors of Creation Justice Ministries, Karen Bigelow and Avery Davis Lamb. Before we begin our episode, a quick plug for one of Creation Justice Ministries' other programs, Blue Theology. Blue Theology is a place where current science and marine biology meets the theology of creation justice. Each summer, we host youth groups to engage in experiential learning, service projects, and contemplative practice with God's marine creation. We have outposts in North Carolina, Newport Beach, California, and Texas City, Texas, and registration is closing soon. To learn more, go to www.bluetheology.com. Join us now as we look at the 23rd Psalm through the lens of creation justice.
Right. Our text for today is Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord my whole life long. So, where is creation in this passage?
So I was contemplating, because I think it's so easy to be like, oh, green pastures or quiet waters. And yes, creation is in that. But I think it's also this invitation to see ourselves as creation, as I was reading it, this sense of like, we are the sheep that need a shepherd. And so the thought of us being invited into creation in this imagery and being invited to the green pastures, the quiet waters, being able to have that, and even acknowledging the valley at the same time. And so I think creation, how we see it, is us being invited into this imagery of what it looks like to have enough and to be with the Lord.
I love that, Karen. Yeah. And the God is in creation, just the depiction of God here as a shepherd who is, it's not just a metaphor of the shepherd in the sky, but it's a shepherd who is intimately connected with the humanity of creation and guiding us and loving us and caring for us, but also clearly loving the still waters and the green pastures. I couldn't help but think of God the gardener as depicted in the Genesis creation passages. And even, you know, we just moved out of, or we're in the season of Easter. We just had Resurrection Sunday and the depiction of the resurrected Christ as a gardener, right? That here's another thread of God as one who is caring and cultivating for the non-human. So, I love the way that the human and the non-human are interwoven in this, both on a metaphorical level, but also just on a creational level.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, I think one of the things that I really, you know, Karen, you're absolutely right that like immediately our minds go to the green pastures and the still waters. But if I jump to the end of the psalm, and we think of ourselves as part of creation, then the table is a part of creation. It's humans, the way that we go about feeding ourselves, the oil with our head is being anointed with is a byproduct of creation. Our cup is overflowing, likely with wine. That has been, you know, again, creation through the hands of humans.
The abundance of creation and the overflowing cup.
Yeah. And then also the imagery that is throughout this kind of gives you the feeling that the house of the Lord is in creation.
Mm-hmm.
That the house of the Lord isn't this separate, you know, dwelling that is cut off from creation. All of these things that are happening in the context of this psalm, the green pastures, the still waters, are all part and parcel of the house of the Lord. And so I think, you know, where you really picked us off, Karen, was really asking us to, one, include ourselves in creation, and two, really stretch beyond the obvious places where creation is.
Yeah, Derek, I completely agree with that. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to go that far down in the text, but the idea of I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And I think that there is this invitation to also think of creation as a part of that house. And so in the sense of, I think it's easy when we think forever, we think heaven, but what forever is also includes our time on earth. And so what does it look like to look at part of the house of the Lord being beyond this, you know, this imagery of heaven, to also being this imagery and the tangibleness of the green pastures, the quiet waters, and even the valley. And so just being able to just widen the definition of how we look at the house of the Lord, and not limiting it to heaven or even just a church.
Yeah, there's a little bit of eschatology just under the surface in this passage that you're getting at, Karen. And there's also the darkest valley, or the valley of the shadow of death. And what I'm reading here is that we experience both heaven and hell in creation, right? There are valleys of the shadow of death that are polluted streams and communities that are breathing in pollution from plastic production or other petrochemical production. And at the same time, there are glimpses of heaven amidst us in creation. And I guess creation is witnessing to the goodness, the abundance, the economy of God's love that we experience at the end of all things in heaven, that is this table that is set before me. So I like you taking us there, Karen.
I think one other place that I want to go, and this isn't a fully formed thought, but if we are including humanity in creation, which I think we should, and I think is right, then we also have to include the enemies that the table is prepared before. And what does it mean for us to be a part of creation with our enemies? What does it mean for us to be a part of creation where the potential for the fear of evil is there? That parts of creation have the potential for the fear of evil. Parts of creation include the darkest valley or the valley of the shadow of death, which just really, I mean, is a more poetic translation than the darkest valley.
What a banging phrase, the valley of the shadow of death.
And yeah. Darkest valley, like, might be a better might be a more accurate translation, but it's a way
come on NRSV, don't take
it's
this
a way more boring translation.
I had a pastor once say, can't nobody quote Psalm 23 like King James for this. that is very accurate.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, you gotta give the King James its due for poetic language sometimes. that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I just want to, I think when we think about creation, to think about the perils within creation as well, right? That, yeah. To think about that creation might also be a space where enemies are within eyeshot of our table, and where when we go through places we might experience fear and we might find ourselves enshrouded in the unknown. And that's a part of creation too, and that we shouldn't gloss over that and shouldn't forget that.
I think there tends to be a saccharine reading of this passage, mm-hmm. that I, all is well, you know, I turn to God and everything is fine. There's no bad in the world, but it's almost like a beautiful piece of music that's in a major chord that has the occasional dissonance or the occasional minor chord woven in, that it's not a passage that ignores the reality of the valley of the shadow of death for any of us, but of course for so many people who are currently experiencing hell in our world.
And, you know, I had, I think it was a seminary professor who said, we don't actually need Psalm 23 if we don't experience Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. Because I appreciate you bringing up earlier, Avery, the thought of like the polluted waters, or, you know, we have some places that used to have green pastures and now they're not, there's no green when you look at it. And so, but it's still this sense that even in the wake of the climate crisis, even in the wake of ecological collapse, you still have this promise from God, or more so the Psalm of David saying, you're still with me, even in these moments. And I think it's always a good reminder to remember that even in the midst of things that do seem like dark valleys, or however we want to quote it as a translation, that there's still this sense of like, God is still present in that place. And I think it's so easy, especially in the wake of like prosperity gospel and other things, to almost fault as if, because of certain things, God is not there. Because things are not good, God is not there, or there's something default that's wrong. But instead, even in the valley, God is still right there with you and with all those people who are suffering as well.
Karen, what you just said actually kind of struck an idea in my head of like, what if the green pastures and the darkest valleys are actually the same place? Like, what if the darkest valley was once the green pasture? You know, like, I think in our world, it's easy to imagine that the dark valley has a history of at one point being the green pasture, which is, again, kind of can work on some metaphorical levels, but can actually work on some real tangible levels for us here.
Yeah, I think that's something I've never thought about. Just such an interesting concept, because the thing is that from a science sense, from an environmental sense, that's very much possible that they can be at the same place. And it's something that I've never thought about it doesn't say that the sheep necessarily moved. it talks about these two places, but yeah, they could be the same place.
Well, and that place can be degraded and become the darkest valley, and it can also be restored. Right, that both are possible.
Yeah. Let's jump to our next question. Where do you see God calling us to interact with creation in this passage? I think we've touched on it maybe a little bit on the periphery, but let's put a finer point on it.
Yeah, I can start out here, which is, man, the first two verses, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. What I hear from that is God calling us toward contentment and satisfaction and limits, right? I literally shall not want. I shall not, you know, want for all of the things of the world that the world tells me that I want, that I should want, or that I need. I shall not want to consume all of these things that are made out of plastic, that are formed by the logic of planned obsolescence, that the goodness found in creation and the goodness found in God is enough. And then also, he makes me lie down in green pastures. God noting the goodness of Sabbath and the goodness of rest and the interrelationship between the two. That God makes us lie down in green pastures, God makes us rest because it transforms the way that we relate to the economy of the world and the economy of creation. Just speaking for myself, when I am in creation where I have a regular practice of being outside and being among the wild things, it's an antidote to the sort of frenetic consumption that I feel in other times. You know, I don't want to buy all of the things that my Instagram ads tells me I should want to buy, because I experience the goodness of the Sabbath. So I think this is in some ways a Sabbath poem. It's an invitation to rest. And Sabbath not as in just like ceasing to do anything, but Sabbath as in delighting in the goodness of God's creation and fully embodying the economics of creation. This like Sabbath economics framework that I know Ched Myers and others have written a lot about. So really a call towards Sabbath, and Sabbath as the pinnacle of creation, right? Humans weren't the pinnacle of the Genesis 1 creation story, right? We were just on day six. No, the peak of the creation story is Sabbath. And the goodness of why creation was created was for us to lie in repose and delight in all that God has created.
Yeah, I had a similar sentiment as Avery when looking at the text. And I think for me, I also want to point out, Avery pointed out, I shall not want. Also, some translated as I have no lack. And so that's also where my mind was going, was in the sense of there's this calling towards being content and being able to appreciate what we have, and definitely a call away from the consumerism that we experience, especially in our culture, especially as someone who personally spends a lot of time on TikTok and other social media platforms. Like, there's constantly these ads coming to us. And I do think that it's calling towards a sense of your needs being met and being able to be content and to appreciate that there's nothing missing in what God has already provided.
There's a wonderful book that I recommend to people all the time called Lost Connections by Johann Hari. And it's a book about the societal causes of anxiety and depression. And one of the chapters is about our disconnection to nature. And in that chapter, he talks about the ways in which, you know, we see this in animals that are in captivity that have been domesticated, how they're lethargic and they're anxious, and like they'll actually like start to pull out their hair and things of that nature. And we're not different than that. we are those animals as well. And when we are disconnected from nature, we become sort of these anxious versions of ourselves that often fill that anxiety and that depression by consuming, by purchasing things, by entertaining ourselves, by numbing ourselves. And, you know, just to echo what both of you have said so eloquently is, the call here is that green pastures, still waters can restore our soul, can like actually recharge us, can make us can take us back to Eden, you know, back to that original Sabbath, back to that place where, you know, where we felt content. And I just, you know, we talk about this in our Earth Day resource. You know, I think that contentment is such a rated feeling. It's such an underrated, maybe even value to, like, not just, you know, I think some so often we're seeking after, like, happiness and joy and euphoria, and where God is calling us is to content, you know, and content feels like it's lower than the joy and euphoria, but in some ways, to, you know, contentment kind of goes along with gratitude, right? That, like, when we are living in a space where we are not just lying in the green pasture, but, like, grateful for the green pasture to lie in, where we are by the still waters and grateful for the still waters' existence, when we're grateful for the food that is on the table and the oil that's on our head, that's where the contentment kicks in that space, that space of gratitude. And, you know, I think, we're led to those spaces to find contentment and to find gratitude.
And nothing challenges the logic of the consumptive economy as much as contentment. That there's a concerted effort to make contentment decidedly unsexy in our world, because it is an existential challenge to all the forces who tell us to buy more and to consume more and to be, that are, we are, tell us that we are first and foremost consumers.
Mm-hmm. Advertising is designed to make us feel discontent.
Exactly.
That's the whole point of advertising.
And to convince us that it is in consuming more where we will find joy and happiness and euphoria, and not in recognizing the goodness that is around us.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking, Avery. I don't think the pursuit of joy and euphoria are inherently bad, but I do think that if we're not careful, it is rooted in the need for more. And so often it's, you know, because even everyone has a baseline. And so even the things that may make someone happy at one moment, you get used to it and then you want more. And so I think there is this sense of, like, what does it look like to find joy in contentment, and a call towards those things instead of it being about more and new, but really being about gratitude and finding the joy in that and the euphoria in the what is now, as opposed to this, like, concept of one's future self or how something will make things better.
Derek, something else that I think God and creation are calling us to in this is to not turn away from the darkest valley. What we read here is, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil. That it's a call to courage. It's not a call to ignore the darkest valley or to run away from it, or even that God is going to save us from the darkest valley, but that God is there with us, right? That we go there, the darkest valley of the spirit, but also the darkest valley of the world. In reading this, maybe this is obvious to others who are familiar with Wendell Berry's work, but it occurred to me that the piece of Wild Things, that poem, which I can read here in a moment, that's got to be his, like, Psalm 23 response or translation. Mm-hmm. Because what the piece of Wild Things does is it also recognizes the grief that is in the world, Well, let me just read it, and then you know we can talk about it a little bit maybe. So this is The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. I think similar to what I said at the beginning about Psalm 23 often feeling saccharine to me is also true of this poem, that I think this is one of his more popular ones. And, you know, it's one that's going to be like memeified and put up on Pinterest. Whereas like the Mad Farmer Manifesto is like probably not. But right, there are dissonant chords in this as well. Right. Again, the grief that he's feeling makes sense. Right. That there is a grief that we should be feeling about our lives and our children's lives. And also that we should not try and escape that, that there's a time in which we seek to rest and delight in creation. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. Right. But we have to go back into the darkest valley as well. We have to feel that grief. So again, the conversation between Psalm 22 and Psalm 23, the conversation between walking through the darkest valley and delighting beside still waters, that both are important parts of what it means to be a creature, what it means to be a human in the world, especially right now in our Anthropocene time.
And I, you know, I think that means to me, going to that dark valley that used to be the green pasture, right? And observing it. Going to the polluted waters that used to be the still waters and bearing witness. Going to the you know, places, the places where creation is groaning and listening to the groans. I think I absolutely think you're right that that's, you know, when I think about this text in the context of where I have heard it most often is at funerals. And in fact, after my grandmother died, someone bought me a quilt, a throw that had this printed on it. And it's a comfort that comes in this passage, but it's a comfort that assumes that there is a pain. There is a mourning that is going on. And I think that's why it's popular in funerals, is because it's a comfort that assumes mourning. It assumes grief. And so, you know, you don't need the rod and the staff to comfort you if everything's fine. You need the rod and staff to comfort you in those spaces where you have seen how devastating things can be. When you see how dark it can get, when you see how painful it can be, when it feels hopeless, right, is when you need the rod and the staff to comfort you. Yeah. So where is there a call to action for the church, for us, in the light of this well-worn but incredibly moving psalm?
I think my go-to is always policy, but I'm not going to go there this time around. So I think part of it is it's being in the green pastures and the darkest valley. I think that I don't think being in one or the other solely is frankly healthy. I think it's a place of privilege to stay in the green pastures and to ignore the darkest valley, but also like there needs to be, you need Sabbath as well from the darkest valley. And I feel bad for those who don't get that refuge on a daily basis. But I think part of it is the darkest valley, especially when thinking about creation care, that can be literal and metaphorical. Again, as Avery mentioned, there's places where you have pollution. There's places where there's so many environmental injustices happening. And so I think part of it is this sense of like, be in those places. I also think it's always good to examine what is the evil that we're talking about. Often evil is this power of unseen things. And so what does it look like to speak truth to power? And sometimes that power is evil, but it's not this unseen thing. It's people who, you know, unfortunately are polluting and companies that are polluting these places. And then, sorry, I don't want to go on too long, but another thought is that the rod and the staff, that's what the shepherd carries, and it's used to guide the sheep, the flock, into the direction where the sheep need to go for what is best. And so I wonder how much of the rod and the staff are also, how are they calls also from a creation care of going back to what it should be, the call towards making the dark valley the green pasture again, the sense of like, I think so much of the injustice that we have, there is a blueprint, there's a guide, the rod and the staff is a guide, like there is a guide for where we need to go back to. There's a guide to, I think about regenerative farming, which is just a huge thing in my mind lately, but I think about how you have people who are restoring ecosystems and going back, as Ray Archuleta, who's a regenerative farmer, talks about. He talks about mimicking God in the sense of going back to restoring and having practices that are in alignment with what God created. And so I wonder how much we need to be using God's creation, God's original creation for these ecosystems and places as the guide, as the rod and the staff that we go back to. And that's where the comfort comes from, is going to what God had led us to as we go into these places where unfortunately there is darkness and evil, metaphorically and literally sometimes.
Yeah, I think I have three categories of things to share. One is kind of for those who are preaching to consider maybe how to preach on this. One is a spiritual practice and one is an action. But it makes sense to me that this passage is coming up during the Easter season, because it's sort of like a story of the crucifixion, Holy Saturday, and the resurrection, right? The Valley of the Shadow of Death, maybe being Holy Saturday. I think there's a lot of resonance with climate crisis and the environmental justice crises that communities are facing, that a lot of them are in their Holy Saturday moment. And that restoration and resurrection is possible. So encouraging preachers to make that connection, both to the reality of grief and the reality of the Valley of Shadow of Death, the hell that communities are experiencing, and the ways in which there are signs of resurrection that are popping up, those glimpses of heaven that are popping up among us. The spiritual practice is just taking a Sabbath. And I'm sharing that with you all because it's something that I am trying to take more seriously in my life. This Sunday, I've decided it's going to be a hard Sabbath Sunday. I'm going to try and do like a tech Sabbath, and I'm just going to sit outside and hang out with a patch of moss in my backyard for a little bit. But I really think we've lost the practice of Sabbath. And again, it is an extremely unsexy practice in a time where more, better, faster is valued. And I'm very much calling myself out in this, that I get so caught up in that I need a spiritual practice that serves as an antidote to that. So asking whomever is listening to this who feels like they need a Sabbath in their world right now, join me in that. Let's go rest by some still waters. And then finally, you know, I think in reading any of these scripture passages where there's creation, of which, you know, if the Green Lectionary podcast is any indication, it's all of them, is to look local. What are the waters around you? What's the state of your watershed? Go down there and rest beside them and look deeply. You're probably going to see a lot of beauty. You're going to see some moss growing on the side. You're going to see some algae, maybe some tadpoles, some ferns. You're also probably going to see plastic water bottles and some styrofoam that is photodegrading and whatever else. All right. Look local, do research about what that is, and then get engaged in the practical work of resurrection of those bodies of water. Find your local watershed group, get plugged in. No better time than Earth Month to set up a stream cleanup or something like that.
Yeah, I love that. And sorry, just one more thing that I thought of. One of the themes that we talked about was I shall not want, or also looking at that as I have no lack. And so I also wonder just how much we can encourage ourselves and our communities to really live in the gratitude of having enough for those of us that do. I don't want to assume that everyone has that, but for those that do have enough, of what our needs are met, how do we really learn what's a want versus a need? And how do we lean into just being grateful for there not being a lack and really just pushing away from consumerism that we have in our culture that's so deep?
I mentioned our Earth Day resource, because we do talk about this passage, and we do talk about the idea of contentment. And I go to in talking about this idea of contentment, I go to Philippians 4:13, which we often read out of context, which is, you know, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But the verses before that are Paul talking about how he's learned to live with little and he's learned to live with much. He's learned to find contentment in all things, in all circumstances. And I think we need, and then he culminates with, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, which suggests that contentment isn't something that we can do of our own power. That we actually need the church, we need the gospel, we need our community of folks to help us find contentment, that we actually need, that it's a spiritual practice to find contentment. And so I think one of the calls to action here is to have contentment be something that is preached from the pulpit, that is practiced in the community of faith, of how do we find joy in each other's presence? How do we find joy in each other's company? How do we find joy in our community as opposed to joy in the things that we buy and in our own isolation? How do we make, you know, contentment, again, going hand in hand with generosity, or Well, yeah, generosity and gratitude. How do we make those spiritual disciplines and make our communities of faith places where those spiritual disciplines are encouraged and practiced and nurtured? I honestly don't know, like, how we get to the other side of our plastic crisis without a shift of our inward lives that points us to a place of finding contentment in all situations and recognizing that, like, that is not natural. Recognizing that that is not natural to the human experience, that that is something that is a gift of grace, that is something that is a gift of God. And maybe it's a gift of God that we find in the green pasture, and it's a gift of God that we find by the still water. And that when we put ourselves in those places, we're more susceptible to experiencing that gift of God that allows for us to experience contentment.
I think that's true. And just to say, I think it's intentional that it says, he leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. It's not like a, you know, I drunk from the water. It's he refreshes my soul. It really is a spiritual practice that I agree. I don't think that it can be done separate from our faith, honestly.
Well, Karen, Avery, I think we've now demonstrated what our staff meetings are like. So thank you for helping to engage with this passage, which again is a part of our Earth Day resource, and we'll just encourage people to, in addition to listening to this, to download Plastic Jesus, Real Faith in a Synthetic World. And so thank you both for engaging this conversation and for all the great work that was done in getting our Earth Day resource out to the people who we think really need to hear it and read it and use it.
Great. Thanks, Derek. Thanks, Karen. This was fun.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for joining the Green Lectionary Podcast. This episode was produced by Sprocket Wagner, and the music was provided by Christian McIver. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and help us spread the word with a good review. Leave us a comment to let us know how you've used the show and how we can make it more useful for your ministry. You can learn more about this and other programs of Creation Justice Ministries at creationjustice.org.
Our story comes alive within these pages, for every time and place throughout the ages. God speaks and is heard, and the enduring word calls us to care for our world as we share the love that can set creation free. Restoring the earth to wholeness, peace, and harmony. Let the songs of the water, land, and sky resound, 'cause together we're all bound. Within these pages, there's always new life to be found.